First, I want to welcome everyone to our Out of the Woods Through Hunting live Discord edition interactive podcast. We really aim to cover some burning topics relating to all threat hunting and security stuff you want to know about. This one specifically is where we're going to be talking about the key friction points, how AI is improving security in general, and what are some things to think about from a regulation or attack weaponization of AI stuff. So first off, because today is September 11th, I just want to do a quick call out to remember those that were lost on September 11th. The hearts go out to all their loved ones. I also want to thank the first responders of that day. Have really great gratitude and respect for them as well. And if you are joining us for the first time, we do have a Discord channel that will be shared in the comments that you can join, and then you can join the conversation, add comments, questions. We try to watch it throughout, engage, and we've gotten some really good stuff from there in the past. Starting out, we usually share some interesting artifacts. And before we get into that, a quick introduction. I'm Scott Poley. I am a senior threat hunter at Intel 471. I've been doing security stuff in general all around. I've actually worked with the two other folks that you'll hear from today. And so we have a little head of lineage together. Tom being the next one, I'll hand it over to you, Tom, to introduce yourself.
Hello, everybody. I am Tom Castura. I am a threat hunter here at Intel 471, but I've been in the field now for over a decade, done a lot of different things, as I've talked about in a lot of our podcasts, but really love this space, all aspects of it beyond threat hunting. But that's kind of where a lot of the core of the love comes from. So excited to talk shop again, Scott.
Yeah. And then Lee's joining a little late because, work always overlaps and challenges us for getting on some of this additional stuff we like to get out to you guys. And he is also a threat hunter, but also works really close with our customers. We get really good insights from that perspective. And he's also been on our team in the past. And I've actually been his team lead even before cybersecurity was our thing. So now jumping into the interesting artifacts. Tom, if you want to show, I'll start with mine. So the interesting artifacts section really is just to kind of give some resources out there for those that are listening, to potentially use as resources, as tools, depending on what they are, as just good information. And my resource that I look for, and it kind of pertains to our talk today a little bit, and that is the GitHub for the OWASP GitHub. They have a project that's called Project AI Testing Guide. And I think it's really interesting because one of the big conversation pieces that come up is like, how do we protect AI? Either is it external, internal based things? What are some of the risks associated with those? We're all having those conversations. I thought this is a great kind of one-stop shop to, there's some good like red teaming guides for how to basically test and validate things. There are like the top threats and risks that they're seeing. And they even have how, things to think about as far as building, right? If you're going to build your own, what are the things to consider as far as like creating it, testing it, designing it? They have some resources there. So it's really just kind of a one-stop place to re for resources. They really, I think, is a good place if you really have nowhere to start or you're looking at exploring the risks with the AI or building your own. I would definitely start here from a resource perspective. Tom, I don't know if you what your take is when you kind of looked at some of these things, if you dug into it at all as well.
Scott, I'm going to be honest. This one is completely in your bag. I did not have a lot of time to go through this one. I do have it bookmarked. I am excited to read this one. So the anything in this space, as our podcast kind of alludes to, is going to be incredibly valuable to get in right now on the ground floor and educate ourselves on. So.
Yeah, I would say the nice thing that I saw, because a lot of the reading I was doing, kind of preparing and looking at some of the things was, we're kind of used to the LLM type of AI models that people use in businesses within security, just in their personal day. But there's a big, I wouldn't say like push or transition, but it's becoming a more top of mind conversation. They're called agentic AI systems. And if you're not familiar with agentic, I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, systems, they're really supposed to address the problem that a lot of people are seeing where you build some sort of AI solution and it doesn't really adapt with how your processes and how the climate, whatever, changes. And so it's supposed to alleviate that burden because it's supposed to be adaptive. It's supposed to be able to learn as it goes based on the inputs that it has, and be a little more malleable to that. So because it's kind of a next more like rising type solution, for how AI is being implemented, they actually have a red team guide for that as well. Which is good and interesting that they actually have that divide, right? Like you're going to test different types of attacks based on the AI implementation or design, which shows that, AI isn't just one big bucket, right? It's actually probably a lot of smaller buckets that people don't actually classify probably as well as they should. So that's, I think, highlights some of that. So yeah, if you've got nothing else to come, what do you got for us, Tom?
Okay, I will jump over to mine. So I have another resource. This is one I found. It's called I'm gonna reference to this guy, but Seed AI, so cybersecurity AI. If I remember correctly, when I was reading through this is actually, kind of coming out of MIT side of the house. But basically, what we're looking at here is a an open source framework that kind of helps allow you to develop AI-powered tool sets, so both offensively and defensively. There's quite a bit in this one. I was actually really happy to stumble upon this resource. Really kind of comes down to what I had said before with yours, Scott, having as much as we can get, especially as defenders, into our mindset and educating ourselves about what's out there, what's being done, how things are working, how this whole AI space is evolving on every aspect. It's just so fundamental. But this one is, there's a lot of depth here, and I'm not sure how much you got through it, Scott, but there's a handful of papers that were published based on some of the findings. They've used these AI models and these tool sets to actually, they've competed in, they've used this exact one, this open source one, to or versions of it, to compete in competitions against humans where they've actually won. They talk about a lot of their challenges and some of the things that they've done in this. They also show some of the actual real world impacts these models have had, these tool sets have had, finding specific threats and environments, finding vulnerabilities, up to 7.5 rated vulnerabilities. There's a lot here to digest. They also, as you kind of work through how they've laid out their GitHub, which I also kind of fell in love with because there's so much information here, but it's kind of really well sorted. So there's, you have, quick access to the papers, you have demonstration videos, you also kind of go through where they really kind of give you the idea of what this project is meant to do and why they're so firm and it open sourced, why, where they talk about how a lot of the even open source models that are out there for LLMs, they tend to overlook the cybersecurity aspect. So instead of keeping this kind of more proprietary, they want it wide open for that purpose to allow the community to kind of really dive in and use it. They're leveraging and go, 300 different supported models. They have all the ones that we've grown to know, built in or stacked into this project. They also have this part, which I thought was really cool, where they actually have a YouTube series that talk you through each part of their project, so you can kind of get more depth there. So all in all, I am going to be diving much more into this. I've gone through a few of the things so far. I was very happy to stumble upon this. I think there's a boatload of information in this one, but yeah, I'll take a breath, Scott. What do you think?
No, I thought this was really cool for a number of reasons, because we've always, anyone that works in the security field, even though we might have a title of what we do, we kind of wear multiple hats, or we have to understand other things very well, or maybe we get asked to do things that are kind of a little outside our lane, but naturally a lot of us just want to be able to solve problems, and if they pertain to security problems, we kind of jump on it. I thought, one, this was cool because I think it kind of lets you do some of that, right? Like maybe you're not a great attacker or someone who can emulate things really well, or maybe you're not really good about digesting or managing like what vulnerabilities should you really care about or stuff like that. I thought that was kind of cool about this framework here, where you're able to kind of use some of these tools to kind of help you wear more hats or facilitate more things. And one of the things I like when it says battle tested, it says proven in hack the box ETFs and bug bounties and real world security case studies. I mean, that's kind of cool that there's something where I would say most average security professionals, when you jump on something like Hack the Box, it still can kind of be challenging if that's not what you do, right? And if there's a model that can be somewhat successful, then I feel like it can kind of accelerate or kind of add that extra thing to, like, if you think of yourself as a Swiss Army knife, so to speak. So I really like that aspect, and I think there's a lot of things I really want to unpack here now to, like, figure out, what can I leverage, what could I do within a lab environment, to maybe add capabilities that maybe I don't even have to buy tools for, right? Like, some of these things I feel like are solved by like programmable tools that vendors provide, versus you might be able to get the information you need just from something like this.
Yeah, and I'm anxious to dig into the sides where they're talking about the leveraging it for the defensive side of the house too, just to kind of see, because that's always been a thing, and we talked about it in the previous podcasts. I'm sure we'll talk about it more today, where that's like, this, I don't want to say buzzword, I think it's too early for that, but the implementation of those kinds of tool sets on that side are, personally, I don't believe are ready for the main stage yet. But yeah, there was a lot here. Hey, Lee.
Yeah, thanks for joining, Lee.
Yeah, I kind of come and go as it please.
Yeah, you are in charge, so you have that
Yeah,
flexibility.
that's right. That's right. Are we
So yeah, I was
matching
curious.
shirts, by the way?
Yeah, we are. Your chest is just bigger, so better. But yeah, from our listeners' perspective, but these tools that we've showed you and some of the reporting, I'm curious if you guys have seen this before, or if you guys have other resources, feel free to share. This is a great place to drop them in Discord if you've got some. But Lee, we haven't covered your interesting artifacts, so you had good timing if you want to jump into yours now, and give us kind of what you got here to share.
Yeah, perfect. So, it's the CrowdStrike threat report, threat hunting report 2025. I love good technical articles. Don't get me wrong, like I love digging out artifacts and so on from there. But these high level reports that come out too are always fascinating too, because sometimes you can be in the trenches so long that you're missing the big picture. So sometimes looking back and reading one of these overall picture kind of reports really helps you figure out where you're doing, what your efforts are doing, and sometimes maybe even identify that you're like off to the side or you've lost sight. But I was reading through this and something cracked me up. And we're going to get to this about the a conversation with AI and enterprises, and I thought this clashed so much with what we're about to talk about that I had to bring it up. So if you do download the report, and Tom, I threw the report in Slack if you want to download real quick and actually show that. But we're at the steal. I don't. But it's talking. One of the things that it talks about is countering the adversary, generative artificial intelligence. So how adversaries are using Gen AI, to conduct their campaigns and everything. I just found it fascinating that, and I don't want to give too much away, but basically, enterprises are struggling to adapt. No, not adapt to Gen AI, but find places where it really, really shines. Now, don't get me wrong, there are places. I love you, and now we've talked about this before, love using AI as a resource gatherer. You can tell it to say, can you gather a bunch of articles based on this? And it provides you links. That saves you a ton of time, right? Outside of that, we kind of use it for automation to like automate our job a little bit easier. But I don't think anything to the scale of what they're doing. We got on page 15, we got social engineering. It talks about how Charming Kitten. We got the click fix and how that's being used, but it showed and talked about how adversaries are using them through the entire process of not just AI collected data. It's creating a social engineering, phishing, identity generation, whatever the case may be. Then after that, using AI to help collect the pro or solve the problems that they're facing. Maybe they are having a technical issue or something. They can ask AI. And it's just using AI to continue the disguise and the like the I don't know, but the whole like smoke and mirrors that you are actually who you say you are. But they have adopted that and used it to such success. I mean, who was it? Man, I always mess it up. Kalima, famous Kalima. It says they hit what, 320 organizations while using this every step of the way during the hiring process and afterwards. So like, not once again, a completely different use case from legitimate enterprise, that you would argue with. But the fact that adversaries are finding creative ways to use it successfully, and organizations are trying, not failing, but where it's coming short, is just surprising to me. Once again, it's not always apples to apples, but still at the same time, looking at the effort, looking at the use case, it's just kind of, it tells two ta two tells different two different tales, if you will.
No, like I think the one thing I love about, especially like, I mean, this is a good report and it's very, there's a lot of meat to it, right? But I feel like reports are almost what we need from professionals to be able to talk to leadership successfully, because leaders don't just care about what you're doing, they kind of care about what everyone else is doing or what everyone else is seeing, right? And I feel like you almost have to be subscribed and aware of these reports that come out on a regular cadence, and then compare what's in the report to what you do. Is a great message when you can do that. Very time consuming. But I feel like when you build processes around that and you do that regularly, it becomes a little easier. But that'd be my biggest takeaway. I mean, there's just so much in here. Like you can probably do more than an hour and a half just talking about this report. So it's a good find to share for people to at least pick up and read later if they haven't seen it yet now. So,
I
so I mean,
mean, it's a lot of time.
Yeah, it's a very big, very big report. But these reports are always so beneficial for a few reasons. One, because they're showing you the evidence. I'm going to say some very obvious things, but they're showing you the evidence and collection of that data, the things that have occurred. But they're really compiling it together to really show you like the trendy stuff, because that's what I tend to look at in these reports, is I want to find the trends. And also something I guess I want to toss a question to something you were representing, specifically, I guess, relatively to this page, but when we talk about actors, and I'm sure we're going to probably touch on this in the rest of the main topic area of the podcast. But do you guys think we need to find a way to separate the discussion around AI when it comes to, are they using AI to enhance their tooling? So what I mean by that is when we talk about like attackers using AI to more efficiently distribute social engineering or phishing attacks versus are they leveraging AI tool sets to adaptively attack your environment versus are they actively attacking your AI programs or your AI models? I feel like part of why this conversation, and even though we are very early steps in the realm of this, part of the muddied water is that I personally think that those are kind of like separate categories, not all the same. Because if somebody's attacking, if I'm developing AI models and somebody's finding ways to hack my models in a certain way that's poisoning them or doing something else, that is a different conversation than an attacker leveraging ChatGPT or building their own model to more efficiently enhance their phishing campaigns, right? But we tend to, because we use AI so easily, so interchangeably, that we tend to run into this. It's a small thing that just really kind of popped in my head when you were going over this page, Lee.
Now, I think those borders are important because, like, there really are three, maybe four distinctions, right? There is the, we have AI internally we use as a business, and we're worried about how attackers can manipulate or use that against us. There is, we outsource AI to third party. So, how can attackers affect how we use that so it's not as effective, so it could hurt us or potentially data loss, right? Because now your data isn't really inside anymore. So there's like the data perspective there. And then you also have manipulating or getting AI to do things on your behalf as far as like how AI is implemented in your processes, either outside or internal, right? Where you can basically that. And then there's the whole outside altogether. Because if you look at like the biggest disruptor in how AI has changed a lot of business. We'll talk about one of the reports where they bring this up. Like marketing is it in sales, it's a huge disruptor as far as like it actually shows value and gain there. Well, it's kind of like social engineering, but from a not attacker perspective, if you think about it, right? When you convince someone that, hey, I want this product or I need this product and how to get this in front of a bunch of people in a very appealing way. I mean, attackers clearly, that's the biggest disruptor from the AI, from how attackers can use it, from that perspective. So, yeah, but they're definitely different, beachheads or attack services there that are distinctly different. That I think a lot of times when people ask that question, how do I protect against, adversarial AI? Like, what does that mean? So, yeah.
And I think I bring it up too to the point because we're all boots on the ground guys, or at least have been at certain points in our career, and we've had to relay information back to people or to executives or to people that customers or whatever, where you have to explain these things, or they'll come to you with something, and it's kind of in this wrapper, oh, AI and this thing, and we have to figure out how to have those conversations. It just felt worthy to bring up that like we're the boots on the ground products. We should figure out how to categorize these right so we can distribute that information in the most effective way possible. But that might be PTSD. I'm not sure yet. I'm still rough.
I think in
We get asked the question a lot.
I think the wording, the intent is the word that we're looking for of, what are they going after? And that's, kind of like right now, like there's tons of malware out there that they have multiple different capabilities, multiple functionalities. But at the same time, it's like, okay, well, how were they using it? What were they using it for? And I this might be a little controversial, but I think everyone, a lot of people were worried that, oh my, AI is going to write like amazing malware.
Like take over. Yeah.
Right? Like this is going to code the crap out of everything and this malware will be unstoppable. And everyone's worried about that. And then, like, there have been a couple examples of it being done very poorly. But then we completely didn't even look at social engineering aspect that just came around, just like slapped everyone in the face, was like, oh, haha, look what we did. Like, which it's a catfishing, it's been around forever, and we should have expected it, but they just did it in a completely different way.
Yeah, so a good find and definitely good points. So I'm gonna pivot, right? So one of the key areas I really want to try to talk through, and kind of like use cases, but like the offensive risk. Like we've been touching on it with the report, right? As far as what people have been doing. But there are some interesting case studies, and maybe some of our listeners have heard of them. Maybe they haven't. But the first one I want to start off with is one that I, when I was doing my research, never really thought of, but have come across personally with using AI to help me code or do things. And I think it's interesting too, because we think about what recently just happened with the NPM breach. I don't remember what library it was with the NPM breach, but the one that had like billions of downloads a week, right? And it was interesting too. The outcome was, I think they made like $58 or $68 on crypto.
67, I think it's, yeah, 67.
Yeah, it was like one of the best breaches. And so if you guys are unfamiliar with this, basically an NPM package that is leveraged in a lot of like open source library and a lot of coding that developers use, that one of the creators was compromised, and then that package was turned malicious, and it's a highly downloaded and used package. And whoever compromised it was really just looking for crypto-based things and that really did not understand the impact that they had by compromising that, what they could have actually done. So I guess good from the defender side. But why I bring that up is one of the terms, slop squatting. Now, I know I've probably told both you, Lee and Tom about this, because when I keep bringing it up when every time we talk about the NPM package stuff. But for those that aren't aware, slop squatting is basically where it's a technique where LLMs have hallucinations. So if anyone's ever tried to code with LLMs, and I have quite a bit, and depending on what language you're using, there's ways where you import third-party libraries or things to help you simplify the code or make it easier for you to accomplish whatever you're trying to accomplish. And I think it's gotten better, but historically, especially earlier on, There were libraries that were mentioned in code that was provided that just did not exist. But the names of the libraries made sense. And when you tried to use the code and you tried to figure out how to import or download the library, you couldn't find it. And it was like a huge frustration from a developer perspective. Well, apparently there was attacks that were kind of occurring based off of this, where attackers would figure out what people were you like what the returns were from these LLMs as far as suggestions for what libraries to use, find the ones that don't exist that are being offered up, and then registering a library with that name and putting whatever code in there that may help facilitate what it is people are trying to do, or may just do malicious things. Not too sure, but they're taking advantage of that. And I thought it was an interesting kind of like out of band social engineering in a way, right? And you're getting a potentially developer access by doing so. So, the lesson learned there is packages that may be targeted for social engineering to try to do what that developer did or what they did to that developer recently. The target packages are commonly used, or potentially stand up new packages that could be leveraged. It's an interesting attack. I mean, it was funny when I was doing the research and found this originally, I thought it was interesting because the podcast that we've covered, somewhat weekly, where we talk about just some of the like news release and top stories, we've seen a lot of like the NPM packages compromised or leveraged, malicious packages, like, some of us typo squatting even for adjacent packages. And we're like trying to question, like, man, there's just like an uptick to this. And I wonder if it's, related to kind of the soft squatting approach where they're just finding out what packages people are using, what packages do or don't exist, and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I was curious, like, what your guys' thoughts were when you kind of learned about that. And, I don't know if you were as blown away as I was, because it was just a unique way to, I think, take advantage of people.
Are you talking to, okay, yeah. Are you asking specifically about the slop squatting or about
Yeah, like,
specific
I mean, that whole
NPM workers?
approach. Yeah. And there's
Yeah, I
probably
think it's a
something
great
adjacent
way
that
to.
we're not aware of, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think it's a great way to, from the attacker side, to kind of get embedded, especially early on right now with the way models are kind of being distributed left and right. But yeah, I hope that that's. This NPM thing is studied specifically into that question, into that area, like into the thought process of that area, because man, that could have been so crazy. That could have been insane. I really hope, but it seems like it's all been pretty quickly covered up. But the thinking about something at that level to the to our, our AI tooling, just I don't know, man. My brain is like going in 100 different circles of worst case scenarios. It's almost frightening.
But I almost feel like one of the only ways you can like try to even, I guess, stay ahead of this in your environment, like if your developers are using language models that help them potentially code or troubleshoot certain things, maybe it's advantageous that other people have visibility to that. So like it's like a shared account that you can see the chat, so you can kind of, I don't even know how you even are aware of some of these things other than knowing that they exist, So, or I mean, obviously education for the developer side to say, hey, pay attention to what you're actually trying to leverage when you're trying to solve problems too. I mean, that should be a standard practice, but it seems like,
Eightfolds.
yeah.
Yeah, and as
So,
the developer standpoint, there should be, I mean, you would think there'd be some kind of a safeholder framework where there is library checks relative to their code in like an environment that's
oh yeah, like,
destructive, maybe, like
yeah, your dev
that
environment
does
should
come
be,
down.
yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Lee, go ahead.
No. So, and I was trying to find, make sure I'm on point with what I'm about to say. Do you remember RazzleCon? Okay, so her name's actually Heather Morgan. And she got busted for laundering money in crypto and stuff like that back in the day. And if I recall correctly, and please, if you're out there listening to this and I'm wrong, please fact check me. But basically, her and her husband allegedly hacked Twitter and got like some, I think they got like keys to the kingdom. It might, I might be crossing podcasts over, but basically, oh, that's hopefully someone's do. But basically, They had an opportunity to do a lot of damage. And instead, what they did was they took high-profile Twitter users like, I think Obama, Trump may have been there, but they blasted some phony crypto scam. And this is what it kind of reminded me of. Like, if it, and I'm not sure if, it's been a legend. I don't know if it's been, who had been found out, but I've got to think that this was not a nation state actor. I think if a nation state actor realized that they could gain access and modify the code of these libraries or just add those libraries into it, that they would have done a lot larger scale of like espionage and just exfiltrating data and listening and watching versus a crypto miner, if you will.
Yeah, no, yeah, I get you.
That's just the parallel I saw was like two great opportunities that came out, and it was like, well, I shouldn't say they were great opportunities. Big opportunities for disaster avoided because of, I guess, greed from the cybercrime era versus nation state getting access. Now, I will say you better believe I truly believe that there are nation state actors now looking for this, or they have already done it and we don't even know it. But now more people are going to be on top of libraries and looking at the stuff that are. Or hopefully they'll be on top of what's being installed in their
Yeah,
environment.
supply chain's always like a, I think, purview of nation state because of the level of access. It just depends on, the level of effort as well. But, resources, sometimes depending on what supply part of the supply chain you're actually going after, you do need higher resources. It seems like if you can social engineer a developer and get to their library, that's probably the least amount of resources you might require, but probably the biggest impact if you plan something big.
All started with a fish.
Yeah.
All started with a fish. They got one of the maintainers, and man, that's crazy. That's a crazy story. We'll have to talk about that again maybe next week, Scott.
Yeah. So the other things that I think are interesting is like how many models that exist that adversaries use. So there's that risk where like, people are like, well, what do people use ChatGPT for attacking and things? And there's guardrails, and people talk about how they can get around guardrails. But I think the other thing is people are actually building language models like Nytheon. Like if you guys aren't familiar with that, it's basically an uncensored LLM. And there's other ones like it where they're designed specifically kind of to aid attackers, right? I want to say that Nytheon even exists on like the Onion Network. Why am I thinking of missing the name of what that is? Wow. You guys got to help me out here. What's the Onion? The
Tor?
Yes. Oh my gosh, yeah. The Tor. Sorry, I didn't.
I threw that out.
But I was like, no way he's talking about that. The Onion?
Well, it's just like a dot onion address, but
No,
a
you're
brain, like
good.
there's so many things.
Sorry, man.
Well, my second guess is Shrek.
Well, yeah, no, that's what's wrong was I was actually picturing Shrek when I said that, and that's what was distracting me from actually getting the right answer. But yeah, like this thing, it's
We've got it in our
right.
ears.
So Nytheon, I think, exists on the Tor network, right? So it's even like this on like behind the scenes network where people are leveraging these things. So yeah, like that's something that you're never going to be able to really defend against, right? And so expecting these big distributors of LLMs and tools to put layers to prevent people from using maliciously is, I think, kind of fruitless. So getting better, and the good thing about a lot of these attacks though is they're learning from ways that attacks have happened in the past. So I think if you're looking at behaviors, for instance, I think most cases I've seen where LLMs have been used, a lot of the common stuff can still identify it. It just makes it where the barrier of making things work, I think, becomes higher. So some of you guys have seen any models out there specifically like that either.
No, not from my experience.
What about like the fake installer stuff? Have you guys seen that with the Yeah, it's kind of like social engineering, but it's basically making like the fake AI tools, right? That you can install like browser web or extensions and stuff like that to get people to download. I think that's a smart move, especially with the high adoption of end users.
Oh, definitely. Just make that
Yeah.
15 the extension. That's great. Like, just install it. Yeah, you're good.
Yeah, I was trying to find because we talked about it on the show, over somewhere in the last 2 months, Scott. I was trying to find one, but one of the things was centered around that, kind of like that Google updater idea, but it was more like the AI model driven, so ChatGPT based. It was like, hey, there's ChatGPT client agent install, whatever, and it was just, fronting. But yeah. I can't find it yet. I
I
lost.
think browser extensions is a whole nother topic. I
Yeah,
don't know
I
what
think
to
the
do.
other thing, and this kind of pivots to two different attacks, right? So, if you have, for instance, a plugin, so what's interesting to me is how Copilot's kind of baked into Edge, right? And if you belong to an enterprise, then Copilot is also then connected to so many other things, which I think is a surface that it can be questionable for me. There are prompt injection attacks that are actually occurring. And what's interesting about those is they're basically like on websites, hidden prompts that if the agent's set up to basically summarize, for instance, a web page you go to or something like that, they're prompts potentially in like white text or so small you can't read them, but the AI engine picks it up and then that prompt instructs it to potentially do things or say certain things or whatever. That can have, especially like when I mentioned that Copilot being part of a browser that could be also attached to your enterprise, that potentially could have some blowback. But also, there was that one vulnerability, Tom, we covered where someone would send the email and just that standard use of AI where it helps you like respond to emails and things. The vulnerability with that implementation was someone, an attacker can request sensitive information, have you respond to the right person in the organization, but the Copilot would also grab that data and send it out to a specific site to upload it on behalf as well. And so those prompt injection attacks, I think, are going to be really hard to see, and it's going to be really more access control and the behaviors around those identities. What I've seen so far with, at least with the Microsoft, and I think even in the Google side with Gemini, the identities that are being leveraged aren't like unique to the AI. It's using the identity of the person, right, that's logged in. So there's some challenges that can exist there, but I thought that was a really interesting attack vector.
Yeah, I found that one to be very interesting too. I'm trying to find the link to that, maybe one of the reference ones. I think I found the Google Gemini one you were talking about, where the Gemini flaw would allow hijacks of email summaries. Is that one of the ones you're talking about there? Okay. You
Yeah,
realize it's still in the
just
chat here so people can see?
yeah, you can throw it up there. I mean, it's just interesting, like the information disclosure stuff that comes from how these things are being leveraged, which is like probably one of the biggest risks most people are worried about. But I think that the challenge too is just how they get integrated to do basically something that can provide information versus taking action, right? There's like two different areas.
Yeah, this one was that one of the other way. I gotta sort these, but there's so much info from the podcast. I'm trying to find that Copilot one because that one was really interesting too.
Yeah, it was a cool one. And then I would say the last biggest risk that I think it's always been a concern of mine, and that is, they talk about how you can beat like facial recognition, for instance, right? And they're talking about using like glasses and specific things to trick AI that can do all that kind of stuff. I've always had, that was my biggest issue with biometrics in general, just because it's something you can't change. And I feel like if AI gets sophisticated enough to help try to replicate some of those things we use for biometrics, then it becomes not a great security mechanism. And they've proven that as far as like I said, researchers have used specific glasses to help twist, manipulate even sophisticated facial recognition systems into allowing access. So from a risk perspective, that's why I'm not a huge fan of biometrics.
I mean, it was good in the beginning whenever, like, I
I mean,
think
it makes sense, right? But
yeah. But it was like the basic, like, and even back then, like, I'm thinking when this was like the whole idea of biometrics was first introduced, like, I remember people being like, well, you know, what if you get, like, it's a thumbprint, right? What if you get a scar on your thumb? Now, all of a sudden, that's completely different. And, like, you know, that's not really hacking or anything. But you're right. Like, things change. The one thing that, like, I know was a big concern was, like, medical conditions, like, especially with, like, the eyes and stuff. But, yeah, I mean, and I think, I don't know how far people have gone away from that, because it's something you are, and people are collecting, like, what you are now. And,
oh, yeah.
Especially the privacy advocates who weren't okay with it already, like, are now probably all the way on the other end of no way. Like, AI, no, I don't know.
You can't change
it. Deepfakes got us, man. Deepfakes got us. The bios are out there. You posted a picture on Facebook. Now we can pretend to be you.
Yeah, and I remember, like, you know, you mentioned, like, even back in the day, remember they used to be able to use, like, fingerprints and things to, like, break into cars? And they figured out how to basically determine if it was a dead finger, because what carjackers were doing were cutting off people's fingers and trying to use them to break into cars. Which, you know, I mean, that in itself sucks, but then to know that they've developed technology so that the finger won't work, I'd just rather not have my finger cut off. Like, let's just remove that incentive altogether, you know? But they can detect if your finger's alive or dead. I mean, cool. My car might not get stolen, but I'm still missing a finger at this point, right? Like,
like, at what point you just hand the keys? Like, whatever, dude, I take it.
Yeah, I know. Like, is it really worth it? So, like, sometimes, like, when we think about, like, security controls, right, and how to bypass them, like, it's got to make sense, too, right? So, there's some of that. All right. Well, so, from AI in general, before we talk about some, like, solution-based stuff, it's interesting. There are obviously our key friction points. I don't know if people listening have seen it, but I'm going to share the report. But it's a State of the AI in Business in 2025 report. And I think the most interesting thing about this report is kind of how they open it up. But obviously, there's some things to really cover here. And in the executive summary, it opens up with, despite $30 to $40 billion in enterprise investment into Gen AI, the report uncovers a surprising result in that 95% of organizations are getting zero return. That's a pretty strong statement, right? And I think there's some caveats there, and they do a pretty good job covering it after they get past, like, the clickbait stuff at the beginning. One, all their collection of data is subjective, right? Because they're based on interviews from people's perspectives. They're talking to the leaders in the specific teams, as well as, like, the top executive leaders in organizations and businesses. And they have a mix between people that develop AI solutions as well as organizations that are leveraging them. But I also feel like sometimes people don't measure the right things to determine, like, success, right? Like, I know we always try to map things to money, and that's how we determine, like, ROI. And as someone who wears a lot of hats and does a lot of work, if I can get some of my time back or be more efficient, I might produce the same amount of work. But if I'm left to, like, I don't know, more my open thought and thinking about things, maybe I'll have better work and products down the road. You know what I mean? That's hard to measure. Especially if the output's similar, but the output becomes better in quality. Quality is not necessarily easy to measure depending on what it is you're doing. So that's something that to take note there as far as that report goes. But it's a really interesting report. They're saying that 95% of AI pilots failing to deliver measurable business impact despite the huge investment. Like, why do you guys feel that is the case in that specific perspective? What's your take on that?
I think personally it's probably more to the side of the measurement focus. So let me try to live fire this thought out and you guys tear it up apart.
All right.
I'm a user. I'm leveraging ChatGPT for my day-to-days. I need to understand how to dissect code. I need to understand how to interpret a specific piece of intel. I need to understand various things, and I'm leveraging this tool to help me speed through this process. I think personally, from usage like that, because there's definitely ways that I've used tooling like that before, I'm able to absolutely be more efficient in my job. But how do you necessarily measure that? So I guess what I'm getting at is, when they say that they can't see the enhancement, it's probably because of two things. One, they're not measuring the right parameters, so they don't have the right markers in place to effectively measure this. I think the second thing is they're probably measuring it against the deployment weight, right? So to be able to put something like this out, so say they try to control it in an environment, right? So they develop an internal model, try to secure it down, go through all the checks and balances of deploying a tool that there are people can use that's not to avoid that risk of something that's being launched into a public model or something like that. There's probably a lot of time and dollar value spent behind that. So when you do that versus or adding in not having the correct markers to measure, I could easily see that equaling out to this 95%, because I don't think we're looking at the value of it right, because we're thinking of it as something that it's not yet in a lot of cases, you know?
Yeah.
Just my 2 cents. I hope that made sense.
So yeah, I see where you're coming from. And look, I mean, I was shocked by this, by the way, because I know how many people actually use it. But I guess, granted, we're not enterprises. We're not rolling this out wide. But you know how many people talk about, like, oh, I asked Chad to do this, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that.
I think the surprising fact was that I think one of the main measurements they were looking at was profit and loss. So, Tong, like you said, how much it costs to roll out versus how much money they're gaining from it or saving from it. And that number was just so low, if not below zero, which if you
so look it sounds like if you measure it over a longer term, you might see the gains, right?
I don't know, because what's the cost of, you know, operating at that scale? You know, what are you paying for? Is it just the model, or is it like logging? Are you how many?
Yeah, was the maintenance?
Yeah, exactly, all that stuff. And then another thing that, I mean, we see it mentions that, like, you know, media and telecom were the main winners of it, which makes sense, because if you can have AI produce tons of ads for you that cost very little effort, and you're just cranking these things out and that's boosting everything, then yeah, there's an easy win there. But compared to like the other results that came in, like it looked like the way industries are using them is like small tasks, like gathering data, things like that.
Yeah. Resistance to new technology, right? So it makes sense that those industries are at the forefront, because they always have historically seemed to be more willing to adapt to new technology, or at least try it. Whereas you look down the chain, you see like energy and materials. It's like, yeah, no, is that we're not touching it, right?
Oh God, yeah, right? Like, mm-hmm. Hey, Lewis, so, just chatbot in OT environment.
So I think what's interesting, like when you look at, like I've seen it firsthand, where teams, they have like a problem that they're like, or like, you know, people want to optimize or do things better. And they're like, hey, what are some of your challenges that maybe we could solve with AI? Right. That's like the kind of approach, or you just basically say, what are your challenges? And they're like, hey, maybe AI can solve this or fix this. And I think that in itself sets people up for failure, because you don't really understand the problem well enough. You know, it'd be one thing if the barrier is like, hey, we understand the problem, we know what it takes to solve it. We just don't have like the right resources or a system that could do that. It would take too long to develop and it wouldn't make sense, versus saying, hey, we understand the problem and AI is really good at this, so we can marry these two things together and then now you have your solution. So I think people are trying to solve too many symptoms with AI and not core problems. And I think that's why they can see like, hey, I can kind of see how this could work, but it's like a doctor treating a disease, but not really giving you the cure, right? It's like, I feel like that's the effect we're seeing a lot of.
I think it's funny you said that, or sorry, ironic that you said that, because I was
interesting thing.
I was responding to Jen here. Because they said, you know, it's a shame because there are some actual exciting use cases. And we've seen some use cases that are like detecting cancer cells, you know, sooner. That is a fascinating thing that if we can do that, that'd be great. But
my highlight there is the data supporting that is very well structured and understood versus some of the things we throw at AI. The data we used to throw at it is not well structured or understood, and we expect AI to solve that part of it for us as well. And I think that's why we run into these walls.
Right. And we're slapping AI on everything versus if we specialized it, if we mentioned it was a specialized use case, this is exactly what it's for, maybe more organizations would adopt it.
Yeah, and to both of your points in this article, references this specifically where it talks about the piloting a tool set to actually using it in production. So the section is the pilot to production chasm. And they show people are looking at this thing, but between looking at to see if, hey, this might be useful, to actually piloting in it, to actually introducing it, back to that buzzword bingo thing. It's like, I think that is. It's so obvious. Anyone that spent 5 minutes at Black Hat this year would have seen that. Like, it's buzzword bingo for sure. So people, it's a brand new technology. It is disruptive or can be disruptive,
They want to figure out how to
but
use
it's
it.
not focused. You got to show people how to use it effectively. And I think that's where you see right here in just that data that it backs it, where you got a lot of things to look at. A lot of people are saying they can solve problems, but not a lot are getting past that we can solve problems to people are actually trying it out to see if it works. And then even more so, once they try it out, they're not actually implementing it. So there's a giant void there, right?
Yeah. So one of the other things is, as far as a friction point, is 80% of organizations they claim are piloted ChatGPT style tools, but only 5% of enterprise AI tools reach production. So, what do you think the disconnect is there as far as why people lean heavily on those open models versus building something internally?
Probably check that, and I would think at least first, do you have the personnel inside to be able to develop a model effectively versus I can just go type in ChatGPT and go start doing things? Like, is the tech that there? Like, do people can people build these models for you internally? Is it just easier to go do the thing there? I don't know. That's my first thought. Like, I think there's a disconnect in that part of really understanding what that means. Some people may say, hey, we want to do AI, but they don't understand the weight of spinning up something that's localized to your environment or to your people per se, versus
Yeah.
just leveraging an open model, right? Or a public model.
Public models have been tested and proven, right?
They're easy to use. Yeah.
Yeah, organizations want out of the box everything nowadays. Like, they don't want to put the time and effort, like Tom said, into tailoring something to your environment. We can do this and then have these results immediately. And that's what I think people hear, and they're like, go for it. Versus, hey, we may need to train this for over the, a month or two to get actual good results. But it would be even more tailored right away, as people are already saying, like, well, that's 2 months wasted, like, in my mind.
Yeah, I thought was really interesting was they quoted a lawyer response to they have a they it worked at a firm or a place where they had their own built-in tool to help them write their legal stuff or construct all that kind of stuff. And they didn't like to use it because the ease of use wasn't necessarily there. And so they pretty much used like ChatGPT for most of their work and then leaned into if it was something really sensitive where the data was more the concern, then they use the in-house tool just for like the data privacy and protection piece of it. And I thought that was an interesting human approach to like understanding the problem, but also trying to get results. And then the other thing was if you looked at some of the results in the report, it did seem like most of the AI projects that were successful were ones that were actually built internally. So it's almost like internal solutions were the better overall solutions, but ne weren't necessarily like the most user-friendly, because it's almost like built by a different team. We've all been in that place where someone builds us a tool and like, hey, use this, and you're like, yeah, this isn't how I would want to work, right? This isn't how I want it. This tool isn't going to do what I want to do the way I want to do it. So, that's a huge, I think, gap when it comes to like leveraging AI in ways like that. So,
yeah, they point that out in the one statement too, like in the competitive argument there, where it just says internal builds fail twice as often, but they are also recognized as potentially being the most successful. So it's kind of like a,
yeah,
you know,
hard to do, but if you can, it's great, right?
Right. I mean, yep.
Compare that to like, and I mean, I hate to keep coming back to threat hunting because we're talking AI, but think about the detections that you'd create in a SOC based on internal workings, based on how you know your environment's set up. Like, you could immediately say, like, here's how it should be working, and here's our detection, versus getting that out of the box thing where you're like, hey, you know, this is supposed to capture this, and then it captures a million different things. I mean, I feel like that, just looking at it and saying the time and effort helps produce a better product is just, I mean, it's common sense, but people don't see it a lot.
No, I think it's an interesting analogy because we've all lived it, where you build security detections and you know that out of the box in testing it works, but in production it doesn't. And I feel like that's the same life cycle we're seeing, well, at least with this report, and, you know, with some just maybe personal experiences where, like, you know, from a testing perspective, AI may work really well, but in a production, you know, type of environment, it doesn't perform at a level that's consistent enough to say it works from a perspective or perception, I should say.
Out of curiosity, do you guys have any thought as to what percentage of the input of this failing or people being able to adapt it properly falls to the folks that are going out to find an AI solution and not knowing what they want that AI solution to be or do, so they're not getting to the right tables to find the right product?
Well,
I've wondered that.
I will always fall back to, I don't think people understand their own problems well enough. Because I feel like there's a lot of smart people that build these solutions. And if you're able to describe your problem well enough and what supports, like what data supports solving your problem well enough, they could probably help you solve it or get you closer to the mark to where it would be beneficial. But, you know, then it's kind of a catch 22. You know, if you really understood your problem well enough, would you have already solved it already? You know, so it kind of becomes that bag of things.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So. All right. Well, let's kind of pivot into some benefits, right? As far as what areas do you think we can, I'd say, somewhat rely on how AI is being leveraged in general for helping?
So
trying to get, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm going to go back to the report for that answer as well, because there's a nice little picture there. The question was, perceived fitness for high-stake work. Would you assign this task to AI or a junior colleague? So for complex projects, multi-leap work, absolutely it goes to human. And for the wins of AI, it's quick tasks, email summaries, basic analysis, which is pretty much what I was going to mention. Or to answer your question of,
yeah,
where does AI win? The summarization, the, hey, give me a quick write-up of this. Can you draft? How does this abstract look? How does this email sound? And so on. Getting those answers quickly and, like, I mean, think about, like, resume building or, you know, like it says, emails here, summaries of big stories or, like, things. Like, that's easy for AI. And I feel like that's where it really shines. But then again, it also takes the person to apply whatever it's going to do or what that means to the right environment. It's like, yeah, it can give you a great email, but what are you going to do with it next? And that's where, you know, once again, it stops and then the human aspect comes into play.
No, I mean, I think that is a great view. Because I think that's what probably some of the problems is. Like, I think the simple tasks, like, we should be leveraging and learning how do these simple tasks, like, how many of these simple tasks can we solve collectively to help us answer or do better with the more complicated tasks? Sometimes I think we jump with both feet in. And you learn a lot, but it might not be advantageous to what you're trying to achieve. And I think that really describes it well from a benefit perspective, because some of the benefits that, you know, we'll probably talk about here, I think kind of highlight that. Like, for instance, you know, this might be a complicated thing, but you talk about insider threats, right? There are solutions like Darktrace that they use where they're basically doing UBA, user behavior analytics, and they're able to look at those behaviors over a long period of time. And I feel like that user behavior analytics is really good for like compromised accounts type activity as well, which is similar to insider behavior threats, but they can see the deviations like that. You understand the data going in, you understand the problem, and you're able to compare to something that's normal. So well structured. So I think like that is a huge, huge win. I don't know how you guys feel, from that perspective, but I know like it's interesting because it's more like machine learning and AI. I hate when people like try to like spell one out versus the other. They'll call machine learning AI all day long. But I think that's a great example of where the data really supports the model, and I think you can get good results.
Yeah, I think, especially from the insider threat side of the house, I'm going off my experience. So I do think that this is a place where we can really gain traction from the benefit side of the house for AI, because it has the capability to more effectively put those anomalous data points together.
Connect more
right?
things.
Yes. And I'm not saying that it's necessarily, because I want to be very careful to stop short of saying this thing found absolute positives, right? But right. I am thinking more in the way of like early days of SIM type stuff, where it shows you things that are that are anomalous enough to look at or maybe investigate or maybe look to consider to put into your environment, into your threat hunt or insider threat program as an effective, you know, box or detection or a data point. We've seen that. And I know, Scott, we've actually had experience trying to do things with this from the machine learning side. So, yeah, I think this is definitely a place that we can get benefits from, man. I guess I'm shouting to the skies. I want expectations to be leveraged, because something that comes in that says, hey, we can do insider threat, it doesn't mean it's automatically true positive. And that gets a little sticky really quick when you talk insider threat. You got to be
asshole. Like, you have to like just like you can't just drop a full AI model and say solve insider threat. But I feel like if you can feed it like here's data that, you know, supports that, and you can say, what are my biggest concerns? Like data leaving a certain way, or users with this level of access, like, you know, those things that help like weight what it would show, because everybody's going to do behaviors that are abnormal. That's just us being human to some degree, but that's kind of the driving point there. So yeah,
and abnormal data in one environment doesn't work in the same in another right. environment in almost all cases, right? Sorry, Lee.
No, you're good. And the two points that you guys touched on is exactly what I want from AI, is the ability to look at large sets of data and then you be able to tailor it and feed it information, like you said, Polly, where you're like, this is what I'm concerned about. This is what would be weird. And then it go do its thing versus, again, coming out of the box and be like, this AI model detects insider threat. Like, okay, you know, how do you know what my environment looks like? Now, granted, I guess it can learn and look for anomalies, but at the same time, being able to tell it and say, look, this is what I'm looking for, I think is extremely beneficial where I want it to go.
Yeah, that's why I think the agentic AI models are interesting, because one of the reasons why people said AI models were failing in their environment was their processes were so complex and could change slightly at any point in time, which would basically invalidate the AI solution they were onboarding, right? And so, you know, that flexibility I think is important. And that's why I feel like what you were sharing earlier, Lee, like you try to solve really complex projects with AI, sometimes that is going to be your challenge. Not so much does AI necessarily work, it's does it work for every edge case in your complex, you know, problem.
With that though, like if you're thinking about maybe a potential tool, that looks, let's just stick with the insider threat thing. If you're looking at a potential tool like that, knowing the environment, knowing what you care about, all the things you just said, it would be really cool to see a more effective feedback mechanism. Maybe not necessarily a full-on training thing, but something that's interactive that can help prioritize how this data is being, manipulated, summarized, et cetera. Like some kind of a really clean feedback thing that would allow the user to interact with the AI more effectively.
That was always a question on every product that when AI or, they didn't call it AI back when I was buying products for our SOC, they use ML most of the time. Sometimes if they're AI out there, but then we kind of looked at them weird. But it was like, okay, cool. Like, how do you train this, right? Like, do you train this? Do we train this? Can we provide feedback? Like, how can we influence a tool that's completely a black box that even they couldn't say what was happening on the inside? They just knew what was going into it from the outside. And if they couldn't answer that question well enough for me, it made me almost like I didn't care how awesome you said it was. Like I didn't feel comfortable investing in it because even if I found something good, I couldn't say it was missing a lot of bad, you know what I mean? So yeah, I think understanding that flow of information and your influence on it is very important.
At least having an understanding of how the model is training itself in your environment to better adapt to your environment so you can then understand how to process and or, manipulate the flow of that data, right?
Yeah. Now, so the other, I think, big winning area, and we've seen this just with building automation, but I think there's like a next level up because automation, you have to think of everything programmatically and solve it. And that is like they were seeing a rapid containment remediation. So we talked about the mixed mode report on our last live, but they were saying like 39% of respondents say AI actually helped them speed up incident response times. And I don't think it was so much that it responded for them, but it was able to enrich alerts and help recommend potential actions. I think that's the enrichment part is huge because we did like what we did with just automation from that perspective was greatly beneficial. And I think that level to still have the human in the loop, but the almost advanced human because you're enriching everything and leveraging AI on the side, I think is a huge reduction in response times for sure. Because there's a lot of work there that gets handled.
Yeah. So perfect example. You get the alert, right? The analyst looks at it and says, okay, that's weird. Hit AI, be like, what's anomalous or what's suspicious about this? Hey, that port isn't normally used by this user. Okay. Where should I go? Look at these couple things. Okay, cool. But at the same time, the query, like, and I once again bringing it back to threat hunting or instant response, this mm-hmm. is my experience. So this is where I like these are the opportunities I see. Sometimes writing a query can get pretty complex, and depending on how you want to tune it or aggregate data, there's different ways and transform the data and stuff. I could see it being like, or AI being like, look, these are the next steps. Maybe go here, and then you would have the information. Be like, here's my query. Plug it in. All right, hey, I looked at what you said. Here's my results. Like, okay, explain the situation and then keep going. I could see that absolutely speeding up instant response versus AI doing it for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I see it as like the next enhancement to automation, right? So when we talk about like when we started when all became a thing, or like SOAR technologies became a thing, where you had this capability to kind of do a lot of that, but you kind of had to program it yourself and get it all ready yourself. I see AI in this place taking that next big leap to summarizing the data, giving you decision markers, helping your speed to resolve faster, but it's not going to be without the human in the loop. And I think most people who've explored automation can understand that those decision markers are the key. That should, in my mind, I think that's one of the priority goals you're going for with automation is not to eliminate the work, but make the work you need to do more better prioritized and more effective.
Streamline.
So you're streamlining. Yeah. So you're not sorting through necessarily a bunch of false positives. You can understand where your important decision markers are. You can leverage that. What I'd like to see here from AI is really kind of bringing all of those things together So like not just like automation, you might run through a gamut of okay, this thing fl this alert ran through my SOC. I need to do or triage this thing, and then I get decision points and then I move on. But what I'd like to see like as part of process times here is to look bigger picture and have more data modeling pieces around it to inspect, like, okay, I had this alert happen. Well, what did it happen 6 months ago? Could you give me another possible decision point or anomalous marker to look at here? Could you enhance that automation piece to that nth degree to give me a wider scope of the threat to my environment? Those are what I see could be really big wins here personally.
Yeah.
I love
Yeah, I
that.
mean, actually,
I mean, it's
What?
just.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Paul. I was gonna stand up. Okay. So no, I love that question. Did this happen before? What did we do about it last time? That in itself, like Tom, that's brilliant. Just having that information. How much time did you save?
Yeah. So, oh yeah. And it, especially if it's presented to you in a way that's a decision point, right? It's like, hey, here's something to consider, or this plus this plus this is anomalous. And that would have taken a given analyst maybe to sort back through X amount of worked tickets or cases or whatever you're calling it in your environment to try to understand or connect those dots. A human's gonna just go through a mucky sandbox of trying to get to that decision point. That's a huge win that can happen here. And I think AI and its current iterations are already they're already buildable for this, right?
Now, I remember, and Tom, you have to correct me if this was leveraged differently, but back when Demisto was still Demisto and we leveraged them for automation, we used them for a lot of the case handling stuff as well because the case management kind of tied into automation and made sense. But one of the things that was kind of, I would say promise, and I would say kind of underdelivered, but the idea I thought was a great idea was being able to leverage past cases and information and decisions from past cases to help influence potentially automating case closures or the case itself. I don't think it ever hit what we envisioned for that. And I left.
Certainly not out of the box. Certainly not out of the box. Like even the attempts, I remember the attempts that we tried to accomplish doing that. And that's no knock on the tooling. I think that was more of
Yeah.
our brains, our we're whiteboarded what dream we could come up with on how
And we made a really
to move
complex chain of
that. Yeah.
events, right? So like I said, trying to apply AI to a complex system sometimes is challenging, but the goal was good and it made sense. And if you could do it, man, it's a huge win, right?
Still believe wholeheartedly that goal makes sense. Like it would,
Yeah.
and I think we're at a place where the technology could realize it and more effectively and
Yeah.
more accurately, to be honest.
Because then you really have to say that someone attacking or doing the wrong thing has to blend in with many different triggers of how they've been triggered in the past. Exactly. And that I think is really hard to do, even if you're worried about something being missed. All that collectively, I think would be hard. So yeah. The other thing that is most people have to say proactive vulnerability identification. Right. 40% respondents to the mixed mode report we talked about previously, believe AI really improved vulnerability management. So I think that's probably true because I feel like a lot of people I've come across that have to manage vulnerabilities don't have the breadth of knowledge that usually comes with all the varying different types of vulnerabilities and what they mean and what the impacts could be, even just by understanding the environment where the vulnerability exists. There's like so much you have to know to be really effective at this. But I do feel like it's also really hard to provide all the right data to make AI effective here as well. So I think there's kind of a mixed bag there. I think that's probably why it's a 40% mark versus, higher than 50 kind of. So what are your guys' takes on that?
I'll let Lee go first because I'm going to be the skeptic on this one.
And I mean, I wish I had more for you, Poy, but I agree. Like, if you don't have the right data and you don't have all of it that you need going into a database, then you're never gonna be able to tell what's vulnerable or whatnot.
Like, how can you really a tie risk to it appropriately? Yeah.
Right. Like in like the first thing that pops in my mind would be like, you know, software versions. If you don't have that up to date somewhere, like, hey, this version is vulnerable. This is the latest. If you don't have a list of all the latest of all the devices or everything in your environment in that database, AI will still not be able to do it. Because then what are you looking at? You know,
well, you're eating like, bad. Yeah.
Right. That's the first thing I thought of, and I guess I'll probably be the letdown, but yeah, that's exactly what.
No, I'm going to pile on exactly what you're saying, Lee. So you got it off to a good start, man. This is one where I assess when they say AI powered as a buzzword bingo, because when I think about this one, I think about, okay, well, what classifies it as AI? Like, what is it doing that a general automation doesn't do in this, you know, when you're identifying
so
you're
automatically. Yeah.
Yeah. The tools have been doing programmatically for years. Right. Like, what is the AI powered mechanism in this that's enhancing what this is doing? Because quite, and I'm going to,
it could be enriching
and enriching. Yeah, maybe, but how? But when I see like where it's talking about, like, you know, it can identify misconfigurations or risky exposures, like that's kind of been solved programmatically. It just comes down to like when you drop these types of, you know, tool sets in your environment to do this thing, do you configure it properly to your environment to do the thing? So like, give me an AI powered tool. It's going to go and look through my environment. It's going to tell me things that are there. Might be able to identify systems, applications, configurations that I don't necessarily have in a portfolio, because I don't think any organization has a clean asset management portfolio, right? There's always those gotchas. But even the programmatic ones can do that as well already. So like beyond that, like this one always falls, the vulnerability identification always falls to the AI powered attack or the AI buzzword bingo. Although that tool that I found that we talked about in the artifact,
oh, yeah,
they did demonstrate how they were able to find certain things, but that was specifically to identifying net new vulnerabilities. So that's where I think maybe
like the undiscovered bug bounty type, or like,
yeah, or things that may appear vulnerable that aren't necessarily recorded as one. So yeah, like the bug bounty type, or just something that says, hey, this is vulnerable for your environment because X, but maybe it's not a listed vulnerability or necessarily a need to have that. Yeah, so that would be something that I would like to see, though I have not seen that yet. But when you tell me AI vulnerability identification in my environment, can you tell me the things that are vulnerable to me, not just the thing that's out there on the CVSS listed situation? Because I could see there being data sets that chain together to say these five things are making you vulnerable because X, not your system has this vulnerability. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I think the one input that always fails in any of the systems, even programmatically or else, is, and I've seen research on it, is distance, which is kind of a weird thing to include because now, you know, people work remote, people are kind of like attached in different ways, you know, with, you know, tunneling versus, you know, multi-bridge networks, all that kind of stuff now. That's, I think, a huge thing that never is going to be ingested. And I think for a system to help you assess risk, especially if a vulnerability is identified and known, like, you know, programmatically or, you know, with AI or whatever, knowing how it's exposed is, I would say, the more important piece. And how to assess that, usually why that's always missed in most assessments anyways, is because that data is not available. Or it's known by a person, but not documented, you know, in a way. So I don't see AI necessarily figuring that out. Because if it's not like recorded, where's the data going to come from? Maybe there's a tool you can build that does that, that then can then leverage that. But I don't think that's what people are talking about when, but the one win I think there is, you know, people that might not have the experience to understand attacks and vulnerabilities and exploits to a certain level on, like, you know, how can three low vulnerabilities equal a high now because they all exist on the same system? I think maybe there's wins there, right?
But that would be I'm not saying that understanding isn't complex, but that would be the simple task of explain to me why these are together equal a high. Right. So I think the win for me here would be like a combination, and maybe this is more complex, but a combination of factors that AI is looking at. So if they say AI, as in you go into your tool and chatbot pops up and you say, hey, can you show me devices that are vulnerable, and it prints you out a list, is I don't see that as AI doing the job, right? The list, the database there exists, the data exists. You just had AI go get it for you. If, on the other hand, you pair, I think what you and Tom are talking about, where you say, hey, you know, tell me a list of devices that are vulnerable, and, you know, out of date or whatever, and it gives you, hey, here's the last, or here's the vulnerable version, here's its version, so compare those. Oh, by the way, we looked at the logs that have been, you know, the events logs that have been filtering through the network for the past couple months. We looked at it and nothing seems out of the picture. You know, combine that with then how is this exposed? Is this public facing? Is it, you know, is it closed off on the internet? I think all those pieces fit together. That would win me the vulnerability management. I think, and seeing AI does that would absolutely convince me that AI won it, because it's proactively looking at all these different facets versus just retrieving information from a database.
What about, I know we've talked about like AI being really good for attackers from like the social engineering perspective. And I know a lot of like organizations, even when they were talking about like, how do you protect against certain user prompts to like misuse an AI, and the common response is, well, we need to build an AI to help against like the malicious prompts. And it's like, from a social engineering perspective, maybe that's a good use case, because if AI is generating things, is to be able to determine, is this AI generated and is this malicious in nature based on how it's delivered or fingerprinted, which we haven't seen many solutions really emerge for that I'm aware of. I don't know if people listening know of solutions that are leveraging that from a counter phishing or counter social engineering. Now, granted, you're now opening yourself up for a lot of data being read by something that you have to figure out how you manage all that. But would that make sense from a solution perspective? Or would you just end up with like everyone that uses AI for marketing in general all of a sudden come across as malicious?
Probably the latter.
I mean, like, it's a hard problem to solve, right? Like, what sounds more human, but what has the trait? I mean, we're trained on traits. Is it urgent? Is it tied to something that, and, you know, and obviously if you're able to feed intel from campaigns that are going on live that have been identified to something that's able to then make that assessment, I mean, that'd be hugely impactful. But yeah,
I find that deeply ironic, because that's the, like, that's the industry that's winning the most from it.
Yeah.
We're like using AI to battle AI, but like they're both in the positive side. I mean, granted, if it's social engineering, that's different. But like, if you could be like, AI, tell me which ads are not created by a person, and they just throw up all the ads, like you said, like we're.
Well, it's like funny because we're in an industry where we create the problems we didn't have to get paid for to protect. You know, like it's just like this ongoing problem creating, solving solution that it's just self-driving at this point, right?
And that's just called job security.
So sick. Cool to see that point, or the AI point, kind of get away from the whole idea of the snake eating its own tail kind of thing, because it feels like that a lot.
No, I agree. I wish there were things in security that didn't feel like that all the time. But yeah,
job, I mean, security.
Yeah, I hate going back to that. But I mean, yeah, so I mean,
double up, please.
I would think the scariest thing is like, how would you tools apparently use it. They advertise they do, but like an endpoint tool using AI. You know, to what level is that effective in an environment? Are you kind of just using almost signature like based things?
I mean, if maybe that's the answer for the agentic AI, but if it can sit on my endpoint and I think if it can look at anomalies, then I don't think it'd be so much.
It's a huge thing. I think primarily when people use AI and security tools, that's a lot of the use cases is that threat detection.
I mean, I feel like that would be a win versus like comparing it to antivirus where it's all signature based, right?
Yeah.
I'd like to have it open. I'd like to see it enhanced to where it doesn't necessarily just track the anomalies, but it identifies the norms. I know that might sound like I'm talking out of both sides of my face, but like you kind of have a set focus to target the anomalous stuff, but that's going to always change over time. My norms shouldn't. So how can I do both effectively to where that it's learning my system? It knows the normal baselines of X, Y, and Z of what I care about. And it's not just telling me about, you know, the given signature or this random different detection, but it's learning what I really, truly care about. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but that evolution over time, spending that time learning your data, it's not just telling me what's anomalous outside of my normal 60 or 6 month window of activity, but it's growing over time to show how I respond to the things that it's giving me anomalously, how it redirects its detection of what's anomalous. Does that make sense? Like more, instead of just triggers, it's more of an adaptive learning set,
no,
like a partner of mine to assess that endpoint.
So I think that to circle back on all that, you know, when Lee shared the right, complex projects, they prefer a human to go towards versus quick tasks, right? And then if you looked at like, answers on some of the reporting where like 50% of people still said that humans should be handling a lot of the tasks in general. It kind of goes back to how do we leverage these tools to make us better, not try to replace us, you know, in a sense, because I think for us to figure out of all the telemetry, what is normal, that'd be a huge undertaking. To some level, especially to capture all the detail there. But if something is able to kind of summarize that for us to then leverage in any capacity that we see fit, we're just already better because of it. And, you know, but all these tools that are written are not necessarily how do we make people better. It's how do we just like solve the problem. And I think that is a kind of a huge takeaway. Right. If you're looking for, you know, solving complex problems, maybe we should focusing on how to enhance the human first.
Yeah. How does it enhance the human? What's the partnership look like? Not does it solve a problem and replace a human? Because that's, I think, the wrong way to think, especially in our industry.
I don't know. It's just something that's changing so fast. Yeah.
I'd be pretty angry if I asked ChatGPT something. I was like, oh, why don't you learn this? And
you're like, did you try reading a book or it sends you what was that site let me Google that for you, it sends you one of those that would
Know a lot of trouble.
Yeah. It sends you just like a man page, you're just like, what, come on.
I mean, it's true, but I guess it's the difference between like, hey, I'm trying to solve a complex problem, give me inputs, versus I'm asking a question. Because, you know, we can all agree that there's times we've asked pointed questions to say like ChatGPT, and it doesn't give us the right answer when we ask a specific question. But if you walk it down like the story of like, hey, I'm thinking about this and I want to do this and whatever, you almost get a better answer that actually is a better approach at addressing your problem. Then trying to give you like the, I'm going to give you that on the spot. I feel like it's kind of the same way. Like if you just expect the answer right away, you can't almost always trust what you get versus going through the journey. So I don't know. There's some value there.
You know, I'd appreciate it. And I know we're running close, Tom, but I'd appreciate it if maybe there's that balance of like, hey, here's the answer. But if you want more context, look at all this. This is where I came. This is where I got it from. These are the things you could do. That I think would be making me better. Yeah.
All right. So that's our conclusion, is it just needs to make the human better. That's what AI has been failing at this whole entire time. And that's the benefit. We solved it. Congratulations, guys.
Solved it. Great job, guys.
You heard it here first. Trademark.
You're written.
All right. Well, on that, we got to cut us off here because we don't want to keep people for too long. But quick announcement, we do have a threat hunting workshop for hunting for persistence level 2 with Lee here. So another hands-on if you've never threat hunted before, a little more advanced as far as, you know, maybe the data and the approaches you're taking for looking for persistence. But, you know, with that, I really want to thank everyone for joining. I love talking shop and just kind of, you know, seeing what we come up with and ideas that kind of flow. Please like and share our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about really anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Leave a good review. It helps others discover us. And for those that don't know, we also do that 30 to 45 minute episode roughly weekly. We hit news topics, intelligence reports, technical write-ups. And it's a good place where if you've never threat hunted or don't know how to approach information to threat hunt, we offer a lot of suggestions for how we approach things and even hunts that we think are appropriate based on the activity and things we're learning. So check that out. So with that, happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everybody.